From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, UW-Milwaukee's outgoing chancellor, Mark Mone, talks about his decade on the job and his hopes for the future of the university. Then we'll learn about plans to open a large convenience store called Bucky's in Oak Creek.
It absolutely dwarfs like any other convenience store you've ever been to. It's, you know, Jupiter compared to Mercury.
Plus, we'll learn about some of the dunes you can visit in and around Wisconsin.
These are about 300 feet tall. And of course, these are on Lake Superior instead of Lake Michigan. You don't see as many up there, though they do exist. And these are the, you know, the granddaddies of them.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect. From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. UW-Milwaukee Chancellor Mark Mone is stepping down after more than a decade at the helm of the university. In those years, he faced challenges and changes in higher education and its students. The COVID-19 pandemic, the rise of artificial intelligence, and the fight for funding at the state level, just to name a few. Dr. Thomas Gibson, formerly of UW-Stevens Point, will step in to take Mone's place in July. Before he hands over the keys, Mone sat down with WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel. They discussed some of the controversial decisions he's made in the last year and the future he sees for UWM.
So you've been chancellor at UWM since 2014. Something that stands out to me as an education reporter is just how much higher education has changed since you took the job. What changes have you seen and how have you approached them?
Well, I think one is how much more focus today students have on careers, and they're continue to be very full of grit and persistence. They've had some headwinds that have changed, you know, because of COVID and then what that's done to a lot of the academic preparedness. So students today, I think, are more stressed. There's more financial uncertainty. And so we've really tried to respond by raising more dollars for scholarships, providing more support on our campus, and being as empathetic as possible. This is a changed world, and the students are different. The employment situation, frankly, a lot of the things in the world are different. I would characterize it a little bit also by saying, I think folks are a little more transactional, not all. They're wonderful, a lot of incredible energy, optimism. They're going to change the world. But at the same time, they're very much looking for careers, very much looking for, whether it's in healthcare, manufacturing, in the arts, you name it. You know, a lot of our students are thinking ahead in a better way. So I think that all the way around, challenges, yes, but a lot of reasons for optimism. This truly is our future in terms of these incredible students that graduate. Now, against that backdrop, let me say that during my time as chancellor, in part because of increased graduation rates, we have kept steady 5,300 graduates per year going into the labor market. And most of those students stay in Wisconsin. It's a really powerful thing. Now, I can tell you this last year, it actually edged up close to 5,500. We really had a banner year, one of our biggest. So we're continuing to graduate highly qualified talent, and majority of that talent, north of 95%, has a job or goes on to graduate school within 3 or 6 months of graduation. It's very powerful. And so we're really proud of that in terms of that stickiness, having our students stay in this area.
I'm glad you mentioned the workforce, because UWM is closing some of its programs, right? Atmospheric sciences, material sciences. How do you see those decisions affecting the college and our workforce long term?
Well, you know, we'll continue to do two things. One is we'll look at projected demand in areas, along with the other side of that is the enrollment side. We're going to continue to look at where are the programs where there's demand, where there's growth opportunities, kind of that internal external view. The second piece of this, to me, what is the right thing to do in terms of stewarding resources that are state and student tuition dollars and our campus dollars. It only makes sense for us to in a world of contraction where we have to adjust our footprint to recognize the realities of fewer students, tighter budgets. What is the right thing to do? It simply makes no sense when we can allocate or reallocate resources into more growth-oriented areas where there is student and employer demand. So in those areas, they're terrific programs. But along the way, you know, let's look at how do we provide those skills, whether it's in atmospheric sciences. What are the types of things that could be built into with some of the faculty that we have, you know, some of the other areas? But a lot of this does take advantage of faculty retirements as well. So those are the ways that we think about this going forward.
How do you hope your successor, Dr. Thomas Gibson, handles those issues?
So I think that Thomas Gibson is going to be very strategic. I think he's going to look similar to how we've looked at things in terms of what are the current and projected demands, both from the student enrollment side, as well as what are employer needs? How do we have alignment and continue to go down that path? And then Tom brings something that I think is going to be very beneficial. He has a background in education. That's where his degree is, and he's very focused on student success. So I think we're going to see a tremendous focus on that with his chancellorship and a closeness and nearness to students that will be wonderful.
I want to pivot a little bit to some of the issues of the last year of your tenure. I covered the revocation of visas from international students and recent UWM grads this spring. Those revocations were ultimately reversed, right? But your administration was criticized for not standing up enough for those students and grads, according to some of the student advocates. Do you think you should have done more in those situations? How are you involved?
Well, I think one of the things students may not be aware of, we've certainly tried to get the word out, how we have worked with our congressional delegation. We've worked with our system administration and have worked very closely hand in hand in a coordinated manner to try to protect our students. I don't know of many universities in this country that have stood up and tried to change federal policy or law around those issues. So our work has been much more working directly with Congress, the representatives that we have, building cases for advocacy through different letters and correspondence with individuals who can speak on behalf of that. We also have had our Center for International Education that has done an awful lot of work in support of students and communicating with them exactly where things are at. So I think that you know, in this role, you can always be criticized for things, but sometimes it's simply folks not being as aware of the types of things that we're doing and making sure that we're really working closely with where there's even more power, which is with our system administration, to be able to work directly with Congress and other governmental bodies.
Yeah, so much of that situation struck me as a reporter as just so little information, right? There was so little information coming from the federal government to students, to universities. And so certainly a confusing time and one that is going to continue to impact enrollment, both in Wisconsin and outside. So,
well, I think you're right, Katie. And, you know, even with the revocation being reversed, you have, you know, questions in folks' minds, international students, understandably. If you were a parent, you know, would you feel comfortable sending your family member, your son, daughter, or friend, a family to, you know, places where there may be that, you know, type of change in the offing. So we're seeing our projected international enrollment are down, and we don't know how far down they will go. It will really be a matter of what happens this summer. And that's also one of the reasons why, you know, when you talk about, you know, being really a firebrand and going out and saying this has to happen or this shouldn't happen, it's too early to tell on some of these actions. We simply don't know at this point. So we're really trying to keep our responses appropriate to the situation that we do know about versus those that we can only speculate. That doesn't seem to help matters.
Speaking of coming out and making a statement, I also wanted to ask about how your administration handled the pro-Palestine encampments and the protests against Israel's war in Gaza. It sounded like you were being pulled in many different directions at the time, but now with a little bit of retrospective, would you have done anything differently?
Well, that's a great question. You know, it's hard to even go back and say doing something different, because a lot of folks don't understand what you just said about all the different pressures that were there. And, you know, what we knew at the time, and knowing that, and having the advice of law enforcement at every turn, both at the local, at the state, federal levels, the guidance that we had was what we were following. And with the peaceful protests, and then seeing what was happening in terms of the injuries and the violence that was being perpetrated, we were advised and we followed the perspective of finding a peaceful way to end the encampment. So that's the path that we went down. It's incredibly divisive. It's incredibly polarizing. And I will put it in the category of the issues that come to me, and frankly, leadership in higher education. And, you know, whether you're in Madison or Milwaukee or Portland or Denver, you know, urban environments are going to have more community engagement around these issues. So you've got an array of significant issues. How did we handle COVID? There are criticisms of that. There are fans of that. How have we handled the biggest budget cuts in the history of the state of Wisconsin? Again, critics, fans, the enrollment challenges, the geopolitical, you know, there are so many issues. And this was a significant one. Just like some of the decisions around, you've talked about programmatic closures, or, you know, when we've had to shutter some campus operations. These are incredibly difficult situations. And there's no right answer. And certainly you have different views, different perspectives. So that's how I view that situation.
You're returning to your teaching role at the School of Business. How will your approach to teaching be different after so long as chancellor?
Well, that's wonderful. That's a fun topic to contemplate. I think my perspectives are going to be enriched and really magnified because of the experiences that I've had in this role. I came into higher ed with a decade of experience in industry, and I think that gave me a great way to be able to bring actual experiences in. And I, of course, continued to consult a lot and work with industries. And then for 17 years, created a lot of executive education and got involved with a lot of corporate, a lot of healthcare, a lot of nonprofit work. So I'll look forward to sharpening my tools and really being able to go back in and make a great difference in the lives and hopefully in the community as we continue to find ways to make a meaningful impact. I firmly believe education is the great equalizer. It's a tool and resource that changes not only individuals' lives, their families and neighborhoods and ultimately communities and well beyond. So I'm really excited about it and look forward to finding ways to continue to strengthen UW-Milwaukee and, frankly, all of K-12 and higher ed across the region.
Mark Mone is the outgoing chancellor of UW-Milwaukee. He'll return to teaching in the School of Business in the 2026 school year. Mone spoke with WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel. WUWM is a service of UW-Milwaukee. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Later in the show, we'll learn about dunes, and we'll tell you about some that you can visit in our area. But first, a popular convenience store chain is coming to Oak Creek. We'll learn why there's Bucky's loyalty and why some residents aren't happy about the plans. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Imagine a convenience store that's five times the size of the largest Quick Trip, a store with 120 gas pumps, in-house brisket, and beaver-themed merch for sale. This could be coming soon to Oak Creek. The convenience store and gas station chain Bucky's may be coming to Wisconsin as soon as 2027. But some residents of the planned Oak Creek location are raising concerns about the project, and in recent months have filed a lawsuit against the city. But what is Buc-ee's? Lake Effect Sam Woods is joined by Charles Usher, a travel writer who wrote about Buc-ee's in this month's Milwaukee Magazine.
Buc-ee's is it's a convenience store and gas station. But as I mentioned in my article, describing it as such vastly undersells it. The chain started in Texas, Lake Jackson, Texas, back in 1982. And as we all know, in Texas, things are bigger. If you take your what you think of as your normal gas station, your typical Quick Trip or something, multiply that by 15 or 20. These things are enormous. I think the current largest one is somewhere north of 75,000 square feet, which is about 15 or 20 typical convenience stores kind of put together. For close to, like, I think 40 years or something, it was just a Texas chain. But since 2019, they've started expanding, first kind of across the Southeast, and now they're starting to creep north. And the Oak Creek branch, which they currently have plans for, I think it's slated to open in 2027, if everything goes to plan, would be, I believe, the first one, not just in Wisconsin, but in the Midwest. So it's kind of a major step, not just for convenience stores, gas stations in Wisconsin, but also for the company.
So this isn't the first time that Buc-ee's has attempted to claim ground in Wisconsin. This is the first time it seems like they're successfully doing so, but this isn't the first time they've attempted it. What happened on the first try?
Well, they initially planned to open their first Wisconsin branch in DeForest. So kind of hit that interstate between Madison and the Dells. And that is currently on hold. There has been some debate over money, because to build the Buc-ee's there, it's going to require some infrastructure updates to deal with the anticipated increase in traffic. Buc-ee's, because of their size, you can't just sort of like pop them off a highway exit like you normally would. Like, these often have their own dedicated frontage roads, often with names like Buc-ee's Drive or Nugget Boulevard. They have their own kind of dedicated road. So there's a lot of money that has to be put in. And currently the proposed DeForest location is caught up in debate over who's going to supply that, like the company, the state government, the local government. So that project is currently on hold.
So your article makes note that perhaps the biggest thing to expect if Buc-ee's plants a flag here is hype. Why is this particular convenience store so notable and so worthy of hype?
Well, there's a few reasons. First of all, it's just the size, the pure size. It absolutely dwarfs like any other convenience store you've ever been to. It's, Jupiter compared to Mercury. It's orders of magnitude larger. And because of that, they can carry a lot more stuff. So if you walk into a Buc-ee's and it's like walking into like a Walmart almost, it's enormous. They have, every branch has its own dedicated like barbecue bar. They cook the barbecue in-house. I haven't had it personally, but it has a good reputation. People pretty consistently rave about it. If you're coming from Texas and your primary customer base is Texans, it has to be pretty decent. It has enormous selection of snacks. They do a lot of their own brand snacks. They're very famous for their, they call them beaver nuggets. They're basically sweetened corn puffs. They're super addictive. I have had those and they're really hard to stop. They make their own fudge. They have their in-house bakery with cinnamon rolls and kolaches. They do a ton of branded merch. They're super popular for that. T-shirts, beach chairs, Christmas ornaments. One thing that I think they've done that is really shrewd that you don't see, not just American gas stations, but a lot of American brands not doing, but that anyone who's ever been to Japan will really catch on to, is they have a cute mascot. And that goes a long way because you can slap that on merch and people will want to buy it. You don't have kids clamoring for Quick Trip merch. Nobody's buying BP or merch. I don't think Sheetz merch sells very well. But you slap this cute beaver mascot on it, and all of a sudden, people want it. Another reason is just like Buc-ee's tend to be very well run. You walk into one, it's super clean. They like to boast about like having the country's cleanest restrooms. That kind of stems from like a single award they won back in 2012. That was given to a single location. I think their New Braunfels, Texas location. And so they make a lot of hay out of that. But the bathrooms like are super, super clean. They have two like full-time employees dedicated just to the bathrooms. You walk in, they're spotless. They have art by local artists on the hallways leading to the restrooms. It is like a very well-run operation. You're never gonna walk in there and like find a gross Buc-ee's. They just don't exist.
You mentioned a comparison to Quick Trip, right? And there's some things that Buc-ee's does that Quick Trip doesn't do. And there's the kind of hype that Buc-ee's has in Texas and in the South especially doesn't compare to Quick Trip. However, we as Wisconsinites, this is Quick Trip country. And so what might this Buc-ee's foray north into Wisconsin mean for Quick Trip?
In some respects, it's obviously not good news for Quick Trip just because it's another major competitor on their turf. On the other hand, it might not have quite as much of an impact as some people are worried about. You're not going to see Buc-ee's popping up all over the state. That's just, it's not their business plan. They can't really do that. You're going to have this Oak Creek location and then possibly the DeForest one. And beyond that, it's hard to see where they might go. If I had to guess, if they try to open another one, I would say maybe somewhere outside the Twin Cities. But, they need to be on like high traffic interstate corridors for the most part. So there aren't that many other places where it would make sense for them to expand to, at least in the short term. Number two, it's not just the sheer size both works to Buc-ee's advantage and its disadvantage. It's not a place where you're just going to pop in to get gas real quick. As I mentioned before, like these often have their own dedicated frontage roads. It's kind of, they're not just, you can't just pop off the highway real quick, fill up, and get back on the interstate. Like going to Buc-ee's is an outing. So for like day to day, I think most people are still going to be going to Quick Trip to their local gas station to fill up. People go to Buc-ee's, yeah, for the gas, but they're also going there for the barbecue, for the merch. So it's going to appeal a lot more to travelers coming up from Chicago to Door County or whatever, or people from going from Milwaukee down to Chicago or beyond. So it's not, it doesn't have the same day-to-day convenience that places like Quick Trip can offer.
Charles, the last question I have for you is less of a question, more of an opportunity to have the final word. So if there's something you think I should have asked about, something you'd like me to know about Buc-ee's, something you'd like listeners to know about Buc-ee's, want to give you the chance to say that before I let you go.
Now, I think this is going to be interesting to see how the local population responds to it. As I mentioned, this isn't just their first Wisconsin location. I think it's going to be their first Midwest location. Right now, I think the closest Buc-ee's is down in Kentucky. If you're heading south on the interstate towards Chicago, like or somewhere around the Mars Cheese Castle, there's a sign notifying you that it's like 470 miles away. So it'll be interesting to see just how things carry over into into the region. Obviously, there's people like barbecue everywhere, but it's not as much part of our culture as it would be down in Texas or even down in the South. So I think that's going to be one thing that people should kind of pay attention to is how it fits into like the Midwest scene and if they make any sort of accommodations to Midwest culture. If we see brats on the grill alongside, their chopped brisket.
Charles, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Charles Usher is a travel and culture writer who wrote an article about Buc-ee's for this month's Milwaukee Magazine. Though Buc-ee's is quickly becoming a nationwide brand, some Oak Creek residents take issue with its development. Oak Creek Neighbors United is a neighborhood group formed in opposition to Buc-ee's Oak Creek location, citing light and noise pollution, traffic, environmental concerns, and costs to taxpayers. The group filed a lawsuit against the city of Oak Creek, alleging the city government illegally rezoned the site for the new store. Mary Ellen Malcolm and her son, Bill Malcolm, are members of Oak Creek Neighbors United. They join Lake Effect's Sam Woods to discuss their concerns.
What are your concerns with the Buc-ee's development?
Number one, it's about 1,000 to 1,400 feet away from the backyard of a number of residents. So there will be extreme light pollution from that because it's 24/7. You can see the lights from Buc-ee's over a mile away. The traffic impact. Buc-ee's has a pattern of severely underestimating traffic, crime, pollution. They initially said 5 to 8,000, not even 5,000 cars a day. Each public hearing, they keep increasing it. A known fact, and if you look at your homework, every place they go, they have severely underestimated the traffic so that they create a traffic nightmare. Try to imagine up to 20,000 cars coming off of Elm Road exit. And the only cross street to be able to get to that in Oak Creek is Oakwood Road, which is a two-lane road, pure residential. So they underestimate the traffic. They don't contribute anything to the Oak Creek property tax base. In fact, what they pay for property tax is less than what we pay as residents. They don't cover additional residential services coming into the area. And less than 2 years ago, I think it was, maybe three, the Oak Creek Common Council turned down an application for a small gas station on 27th and Oakwood, saying we don't need more gas stations. There's seven of them in a 1.5-mile area. So this is less than maybe a half a mile from where Buc-ee's is going to go. So why is it okay for Buc-ee's to add 120, but this other person couldn't add one on 27th and Oakwood? There's contradictions and false information that they bring to the city. And that's the concern, that the facts are not there. We are not against development, but that is the wrong development for that property.
So I imagine Buc-ee's and supporters of this development will point to things like job creation and needed economic development, and that you all are just a few concerned citizens getting in the way of that job creation, that development. So I'm asking you to speak to a hypothetical, but what would you say to someone who thinks along those lines?
We're not against development. In fact, Buc-ee's may be something that a lot of people want. But the facts or the report that we have on our website called The Burden of Buc-ee's needs to be evaluated and see, is there a better place for that than right on the Root River or right on top of a residential neighborhood? Can the city support that? And while we have people that are excited, and I can get that, they have good beef brisket, is this the right place for it in Wisconsin? And that's what we're trying to get out there. And we're trying to get the facts so that if people look at it objectively, is this the right location for it? And we feel that the hidden costs or the hidden burden of it in this particular area is not good for Oak Creek, is not good for Franklin, Caledonia, and it outweighs the excitement of getting beef brisket. And by the way, they don't even have enough parking spots for what they're projecting. People stay at the pump sometimes an hour because they can't find a parking spot. So what type of a traffic jam are we going to have? And again, they view this as the Disneyland of gas stations. So how much access will local people have to it since they're trying to pull people from out of state? That's why we thought maybe further down toward the southern border, where you don't have all these other factors that could make it not a good location. And we even asked them, have they considered that?
Yeah, based on our research from Indeed and Glassdoor, the reviews there show that the people who work there do not recommend it by an overwhelming majority. The quality of the jobs certainly are up for debate and question. They have large amounts of turnover there. So, the economic benefit of one of these locations is ultimately going to come down to a drain on Oak Creek and the surrounding areas. Lots of people don't prefer working there. And, you might say, like, well, who would want to work at a gas station anyway? There's plenty of reviews for other locations and other gas stations and other companies that show the exact opposite of employee satisfaction. The quality of the job that people would be touting for this, like, really aren't there. In fact, Buc-ee's has shown a history of suing former employees who left too soon.
Yeah, one thing also I want to add, Sam, is the tax base. You talk about economic development. Oak Creek is the home to Amazon, to IKEA, to a large Target. Yet our property tax base is about $1,100 more than a similar property in Franklin. So all this economic development with businesses coming, we as taxpayers have not seen it. And I would question how much benefit this is actually going to come to Oak Creek, since we don't get a lion's share of the sales tax. We don't get a lion's share of any of the revenue. And the fact that the tax of that property is significantly less than a residential area or even agriculture.
Can you tell me about the lawsuit filed against the city of Oak Creek?
When we went to the public hearings, there were certain actions that the city was taking that was not following their own ordinance, like basically spot zoning. And there were other things that we actually were not getting answers from the city. And the feeling from the group was we needed to have some representation because the city, for whatever reason, was not open to looking at the facts or listening to us. So that's when we secured an attorney who was experienced in these types of situations. In fact, he successfully fought the slaughterhouse in Franklin, and he definitely looked at the facts and said the city violated their own ordinances. They did spot zoning, which is for the benefit of one property owner, not the benefit of the citizens. So based on that, we took the decision that, yes, the only way for the city to take us seriously was to file the lawsuit.
Yeah, this definitely wasn't our first move there. We tried bringing our concerns before the council, and they had largely been disregarded. They've been disregarding their own rules even and their own prior judgments. And we're having a heck of a time trying to figure out why. You know, why are they favoring this huge out-of-state, this Texas gas company over its own residents and the people within it?
What is the stakes of this lawsuit? So if you win this lawsuit, what happens?
If we win the lawsuit, then they will have to go back and follow the proper procedures and start from the beginning and making sure that they don't do any violation of their ordinances. We're not suing for money. We just want to make sure that all the facts are put in there, that all the costs are available, and we're just trying to do what's right for the city of Oak Creek. There was a motion. There was a hearing in front of the judge. There is a follow-up hearing where the city presents saying we filed a frivolous lawsuit, which when you read the lawsuit, you'll see we have our facts. That is not frivolous. Then we have an opportunity through our attorney to respond. And I'm not going to second guess what is being said by the city. I'm not going to second guess what the judge will do, and I'm not going to second guess what our attorney will do. But we feel that with the facts that we have, that we want our day in court, and we want the justice to be done, that it's not a violation of the law to the benefit of an out-of-state development company. If the city had followed their proper procedures, maybe this wouldn't even be going that far. In fact, there was one mayor in Texas that stood up for what was right and said, this is not good for our city, and we're not going to have it come into our city. So if you start digging into the facts, that's when you see a pattern of operation, or what we call a modus operandi. So again, as a reasonable person, what is the motive? What are they hiding? Is there corruption? Was it like Palmer Lake? What would a reasonable person think if they're not even trying to follow their own rules?
Yeah, there are really some bizarre things that have happened. They spent a good chunk of time on changing an imaginary street. It's a road that doesn't even exist yet, and the Planning Commission had six questions about this imaginary street. But when this 74,000 square foot mega gas station came up, it was just waving them on past, no questions from any of the council until the residents started bringing up concerns.
So Buc-ee's has expanded aggressively out of Texas in recent years. Are there other locations that you look at as precedent for your concerns?
There are cities all over the country, Colorado, Virginia, Tennessee, even Florida, that are fighting against this. And some of them actually won. In Palmer Lake, Colorado, for instance, the mayor was found to be involved in disregarding the rules of the city and ended up getting recalled because of it. North Carolina, their citizens rejected a Buc-ee's as well. So we're not alone in this fight, and every penny that we raise for this effort goes to strictly just legal funds. Like, none of us are getting paid for this. We're trying to do this in the precious free time that we have, and we're doing it out of love for our fellow residents. There's a lot of things that are very concerning about it, and I think it's a terrible idea.
Well, Mary Ellen and Bill, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That was Mary Ellen Malcolm and Bill Malcolm, members of Oak Creek Neighbors United. They spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods. You can learn more about Buc-ee's and Oak Creek Neighbors United at WUWM.com. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, the Midwest isn't exactly known for its vast sand dunes, but we do have them here in Wisconsin. We'll tell you about some you can visit next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you made a list of all the different ecosystems in Wisconsin, it might take you a while to get to sand dunes. We're not exactly the Sahara or a vast oceanfront coastline. But Kevin Revolinsky is here to change perceptions. He wrote all about the dunes of the Midwest, what exactly sand dunes are, how they got here, and where you can go to see some yourself. He joins Lake Effect Sam Woods to share more.
Let's start with your recommendations, starting all the way up on Michigan's Upper Peninsula at the Grand Sable Dunes. What's unique about these dunes?
Well, these are about 300 feet tall. And of course, these are on Lake Superior instead of Lake Michigan. You don't see as many up there, though they do exist. And these are the granddaddies of them. And it's part of Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore, actually. And it's about a 5 mile stretch of them, and they're perched dunes. So they got that added height. And when you look down from them, you can see what looks like the Caribbean, because all that sand, gets under the Lake Superior waves. And when the sun catches them, it looks incredible. And you think, wow, have I gone to the tropical islands? Of course, if you put your foot in the water, that illusion is dispelled, let's say.
Continuing our tour east to Michigan's Lower Peninsula, we get to the next recommendation on your list, Sleeping Bear Dunes. And you mentioned in your article that Sleeping Bear Dunes is the star of Midwest dunes. What gives it this distinction in your mind?
It's certainly one of the most photogenic, and it also gets 1.5 million visitors each year. So, it's quite a large park. There's a scenic drive through the park, and there's observation platforms where you can get out of your car and look out over the sloping sand to Lake Michigan. And the tallest rise up over 450 feet. These are perch dunes in that case, but they're also shore dunes, and they're active. So the wind moves them each year. So they're gradually going somewhere.
So continuing our tour south to the Indiana Dunes, just east of Chicagoland, what is special about these dunes?
Well, I think it's just the surprise that they're there. You know, you come out of Chicago and now you come up against, 25 miles of shoreline that is, its own ecosystem. You've got dune complexes. A lot of them are stabilized dunes, meaning they've got plants growing on them, trees, what have you. And there's hiking, a lot of hiking there. And it's actually a state park and a national park. So they're kind of Siamese twins in that sense. The tallest of them, is at 120 feet, I believe. And then there's a dune challenge for the hikers. So about a 1.5 mile trail with sand and steps that gets you about 552 feet climbing up and down, vertical gain.
Yeah, vertical gain indeed. And I'm getting the sense that part of the appeal for these dunes is that, well, it's a really big, tall thing that I want to climb.
I think so. It's the challenge because it's also kind of strenuous to walk in sand, obviously, but also it's just you see something tall, you just want to climb it. As a kid, you want to climb the tree. Adults want to climb Mount Everest. You see a tall dune, you think, I can go straight up that thing, which might not necessarily be the case. They are, with the steep sand, it can be kind of challenging. So it's nice when they have actual trails or steps. Or in the case of Sleeping Bear, you can actually drive up to the top along the back there and get out on the observation deck.
We'll end our tour at Kohler Andre State Park, just north of Milwaukee. And now after this interview, I'm going to go visit these dunes with another Lake Effect producer, Jimmy Gutierrez. But before I go, what's special about Kohler Andre? What do I have to look forward to at this place?
Okay, it's special because, one, it's close. It's very beautiful and accessible. And they have a cord walk. So instead of getting your shoes full of sand, you get to walk on these pieces of wood among the dunes. And it makes for a really nice trail. The dunes there are only 10 to 20 feet tall at the tallest. And, it's an easy day trip and enjoyable for the kids. Some of the other parks you're going to find are a lot taller and a little more work.
I mentioned I'll be headed up to Kohler Andre here after this interview. But before I go, what tips do you have for myself and other hikers of these dunes?
You're going to want to wear shoes. A lot of people think, well, it's like the beach. I'll just go barefoot. But especially in the hot sun in the summer, it's going to burn your feet. I mean, it gets pretty wicked up there. One of the park managers I spoke with recommend the athletic sandals. I don't personally have those. I just wear my regular shoes and deal with the sand removal later. But you're going to want to have sunscreen, obviously not a lot of shade on a bare dune, a hat, water. Heat stroke is something that they deal with at some of these places in the summer a lot. Sleeping Bear gets a lot of people that suffer from that. So you want to have water, and it's a lot hotter on the sand. So, and if you're swimming, Lake Michigan is infamous for rip tides, rip currents. I know up at Whitefish Dunes in Door County, that's an issue. You want to be aware of that hazard and know what to do if you happen to get into one. So
shoes, water, sunscreen. Got it. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect and for getting me ready for this trip to the dunes. I'm going to take your advice and go see what Kohler Andre is all about.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Now, Jimmy, I know you were saying before that you have seen all the Dune movies.
Seen them all.
All three.
All three of them.
And read the book.
I was a youngster back then, but...
Does this sound at all like the landscape that you were...
It does not,
about?
No. And that I've seen with my own eyes. For one, we have a lake, so we have a lot of water.
A big body of water,
yeah. Huge natural resource there.
I don't see anything here about sandworms.
No so sandworms.
As well.
Lots of wildlife. Lots of conserved natural areas. Mm-hmm. So it also says this 135-acre state natural area protects the rare dune community and four threatened plants. It's one of over 300 natural areas that are preserved for education, research, and the benefit of future generations. How about that, considering future generations?
Look at us. Yeah, we're thinking of the kids here.
All right.
The dunes are for kids.
Dunes are for kids. You want to go check this out?
Yeah, let's do it. Dune boys.
Okay, this is lovely.
Yeah. You can see the
diversity of the ecosystem here. Really, you can't see too much sand. There's a lot of grasses, really some trees.
Not a single sandworm to be seen.
Hello, fellow Dooners. How are we doing today?
Good.
They got it. They understood the assignment.
Yeah. I'm Phyllis McKenzie. I'm a naturalist here at Colorado State Park.
All right, I think we just have a couple questions. One, so I've seen the movie Dune, and this does not look like dunes. What is a sand dune?
A sand dune is a compilation of sand that comes in from off the lake, okay. Or from areas that are inland. So in our case, we have sandy beaches. The wind blows the sand up into dunes. Plants or something else holds that sand in place. It becomes an obstacle or a barrier. Okay. So then the sand doesn't disappear. It continues to pile up. Eventually, plants will grow. That continues to hold sand in place, so the dunes get bigger. And there are layers of dunes. And the further inland a dune is, the more stable it becomes, and more plants can get established there.
So you were talking about further inland, that the dunes are kind of more permanent, more stable, less probably affected by everything that's happening with the lake, or maybe I'm making
yes.
that. Okay,
that's,
okay.
That's true.
Okay,
that's good.
Nailed that. But how much do the dunes closer to the shore change over time? Like, if you have like a favorite dune, you know, after 5-10 years, would it still be there, or would it change to a place where it's like unrecognizable? Like, how impacted are the dunes that are closer to the shore?
So the dunes closest to the shore are heavily impacted in the winter because our winter storms tend to be a little bit stronger off the lake. So the sands blow up or may disturb those dunes a little bit more. Okay. The dunes get more disturbed if people walk on them. Because if you bare the soil, many of the dunes have what is considered a soil crust. It's actually a kind of moss.
Okay.
And it's not super pretty. It's not like your fancy green moss that you see in the woods.
Yeah.
In a lot of places in the dunes, it looks like burnt carpet.
Okay.
It's extremely important in terms of holding the soil in place. Mm. But it can also be buried, so it can be under some sand now.
Okay.
So you may not see it. But if that gets broken through, then you have erosion.
So what I'm hearing is we should stay on the cordwalk.
That would be really good, yeah. Staying on the cordwalk or staying on the beach, but not on the dune.
Not on the dune, okay.
Yeah.
I was curious how old these dunes are. Like, how far back does this ecosystem go here?
So these dunes basically have formed since Lake Michigan took its most current form. Some, like, 16,000 years ago, we were under ice.
Okay, yes.
And the ice started to melt, the glaciers melted, but the first glacial lake basin was actually larger than the current Lake Michigan basin. Mm. And to the west on our property, on the Ancient Shores Trail, you actually come to what is kind of the leftover terrace from that larger lake basin.
Okay.
At some point, the lake levels dropped, the ice retreated, right. And so Lake Michigan took its more current form somewhere 12 to 14,000 years ago.
Okay.
And so these dunes have been forming ever since.
Is there anything that you ask visitors to pay attention to that they don't usually notice around the dunes?
That's a good question. What you may have noticed in a couple of places where you're walking is in those more stabilized dunes, we may actually have more non-native grasses, not always invasive, but like even bluegrass or other grasses, because everybody who walks here has the potential to bring in seeds on their shoes. And something to be aware of in the dunes, late summer we start seeing lots of really pretty purple flowers in our dunes. Unfortunately, those are virtually all invasive.
Oh, no.
Those are all spotted knapweed.
That did stand out as
beautiful. They're very pretty, and the bumblebees will actually go to them.
Yeah,
we even have pictures of rusty patch bumblebees on invasive species. So we'd like to have more natives. So we do ask that people don't take any seeds with them, don't move the plants around, and do watch what you're doing with your firewood, too.
Phyllis was great.
Phyllis was great.
All right, so here's my takeaway that you didn't ask for.
No, I was...
Dunes and the ecosystem and everything that supports dunes for a sand dune to actually happen is quite incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And there are tons of things I've learned about. Well, actually, everything I've learned has been pretty much directly from Phyllis. But I have such an appreciation for the kinds of places and wildlife and habitats that exist in the state that I didn't know and had no idea before we took this little trek.
Yeah.
Thank you for making this happen.
Yeah, my takeaway, I like the ephemeral and ever-changing part of the Doom, idea of the
Doom.
You
relate to that.
Sure, I guess. Got to be. You know, you can, I like looking out at these hills and wondering what they would have looked like, you know, 5 years ago, 50 million years ago, however much. And then listening to the wind that is constantly blowing here and listening to the thing that is changing those dunes, changing the shape of what I'm seeing, and just being there for that moment. I love that.
That was Lake Effect Sam Woods, Jimmy Gutierrez, and writer and author Kevin Revelinsky. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about the people killed in the Bayview Massacre, what happened to them, and where some of them were buried. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.